Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, my name's Guy, and I'm an alcoholic. The purpose of the prime time Saturday night meeting is to talk about the reason to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to describe the disease of alcoholism, not just as a word, but as a living, mind-powered disease, how the disease appears and functions, so awareness of the disease is there to see and recognize. Alcoholism is called ism because it is alive and functioning and needs to be treated. We discuss here strictly the disease as it functions in each of our own personal lives, the way our behavior is this day, the way we react or look at people, places, and things. We do not talk about drunkologues, yesterday's problems, or blaming other people. We talk only about looking inwardly, describing how self behaves in the day that we are in. We do refer to steps, but only in describing the treatment or non-treatment of our disease today. This is not a step study meeting. The format is, first we will have a speaker who will talk about the purpose of coming to AA for approximately 25 to 30 minutes. Then we will have sharing or questions and answers. Sharing is strictly limited to 3 to 5 minutes. We want everyone to have a chance to participate. We ask that share about alcoholism, ego, and self-obsession. If you do not stick to the format, you may not be called on in the future. We do not allow foul language. As many people bring their children to this meeting at the... Okay. My name is Guy, and I am an alcoholic. We talk about the reason to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1975. I was 13 years old, and the authorities thought that taking a big gulp cup of wine cooler to school was a bad idea. I couldn't see it at the time. I thought that maybe, you know, that was a good idea. It was my mom's favorite kind of drink. And 5 years later, she expired from cirrhosis of the liver that was brought on by the disease of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a very powerful disease. It kills people, ruins relationships, destroys families and many lives. And I suffer from alcoholism. And the reason I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is to find out something about the disease of alcoholism and what makes me an alcoholic. I learned from reading the book and coming to meetings that, you know, alcoholism is it's a twofold disease. It's the body and the mind. Dr. Silkworth writes that he describes this phenomenon of craving, the thing that happens to an alcoholic, and it only happens to alcoholics. So once an alcoholic takes alcohol into their system, their bodies see that as a sign to take more in. They're allergic to it. You know, when people are allergic to strawberries or milk or whatever, it'll manifest itself in some form of physical thing that happens to the body, a rash, or I have, you know, a lot of allergies and weeds and things like that make my nasal passages clog up and I can't breathe very well. But an alcoholic, all it does is it creates in me a desire for more alcohol. And every time I put alcohol into my system, that's what happens to me. And I know that as a fact today in my life. And although I try to deny that time and time again, by seeing people in Alcoholics Anonymous share about their stories and what happens to them when they start drinking, I can see that relationship to my life. And I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous so I can see that. But also I have to see what's happening in the mental aspect of the disease. Why is it that a person that has restraining orders and jail sentences and loss of career, inability to do these things because of my drinking habits, doesn't just quit. You know, a normal drinker, when they, maybe even a heavy drinker, when confronted with some of those issues that I described in my personal life, the consequences of my drinking, would look at that and say, wow, maybe I should slow down on my drinking, or maybe I should quit entirely. And that's what a normal drinker does, or a heavy drinker does. They stop drinking. They can walk away from it. But I've, through the use of alcohol in my life, I've created a mental obsession to drink more and more. Every time I'm confronted with some kind of life issue, that's what I turn to. Things can be going great, and I'll turn to alcohol. Things can be going poorly, and I'll turn to alcohol. Things can just be normal, and I'll drink, because that's what my mind would tell me to do. I would drink over and over and over again. And then I have to look at what makes me an alcoholic. I looked at the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the chapter, There Is a Solution. It talks about a well-to-do businessman that goes to Europe and he studies under this Dr. Jung. And he spends a year abstinent from alcohol, and Dr. Jung is trying to apply this moral psychology. Some would say that our steps 4 through 12 are based in this type of moral psychology. You know, paying restitution, looking at oneself's actions and things like that in their life. And that's what Dr. Jung was trying to do with this fellow Roland. And after 52 weeks, Roland came back to the States, and within a couple of months he was drunk again. And as bad as ever, as bad as he had ever been drunk in his life before, causing all the problems over and over again. So what I see in that, when Roland went back to Dr. Jung, Dr. Jung told him that, although I've tried all this moral psychology to the best of my ability, and I thought it was going to work for you, but it seems to be failing, there's some people, this happens occasionally, is that they'll have some kind of spiritual awakening. They'll have some kind of empowerment from outside sources. It doesn't happen very often, but it happens occasionally. And all I can suggest to you is that you go back to the States and try and find some kind of a power in your life. Try and find some kind of a God, because obviously you can't apply these things to your life. And that's what I see what makes me an alcoholic, is that I can try. I can have all the moral and philosophical convictions galore in my life, but I can't apply them. Nor can I wish away any of the self-centeredness, this obsessive behavior that I have about me. Which brings me to the idea of about self. I have an idea of self that self has the authority in my life. Self tells me what to do. Self has just, it's what I want, what I think I need. All the character that I build up in my life is wrapped around this self. I think I need something. You know, there's been many descriptions that I see about this idea of self, and Terry Gorski describes it as, you know, we have a thought, I have a feeling after the thought, which brings about an urge that causes an action. So I have a thought about something, you know, I need a new car, you know, and I think that I need a new car, and I get a feeling that, boy, I'm less than that person over there because they're driving a nice car, or that thing over there, or maybe if I get that nice car, I'll get the girl. So I start to energize this thought in my head, and it really drives an urge to get that car. And now I start acting as if I need that car, and I start to work harder for that thing that I need in my life. And this is always, you know, it could be a car, it could be a woman, it could be some kind of prestige in my life, anything that'll motivate me by self. So I have an idea, you know, in my head, and I start to energize it. It creates that urge and causes me to act. And when Gorski tried to treat that through that thoughts, feelings, urges, and actions, I see that and I try to apply that in my life. But every time I get to that same point again, it happens again. Boom. I'm doing what I said I wasn't going to do over and over and over again. And the reason that that happens, I find in doing some of the research around here, is that the power that I turn to when I do that is the power of my ego. And, you know, it's the only power that I've really ever known in my life. You know, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I see this, I'm powerless, but I don't understand what that means. So the power that I find in my ego in Freudian psychology, he talks about the ego. And I've heard many people in Alcoholics Anonymous say, you know, I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And Freud talks about the idea of the ego as being the id, the ego, and the superego. So the id is that inferiority complex type of thing going on in my life. And then the superego is that manic thing that's happening in my life. So I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And he describes how the ego is supposed to moderate between those two. But I have a childish ego. My ego never grew up enough to learn how to moderate between these two things. And I find that the learning in here is that the four characteristics of the ego being this impatience, you know. I'm impatient. I'm childishly impatient all the time. I want what I want when I want it, and I need it now. So when I have a desire of self, I need it now. I got to get moving. I got to get forward on this thing because where I'm at, what I'm doing right now isn't good enough. The things I have in my life aren't good enough. So this ego takes over. It's impatient. So I can either, seeing that I have this childish impatience, it can't moderate between that id and the superego, and I'm running. You know, I'm telling you how great I am and how important I am. I'm more demanding to other people, or I'm more affectionate and loving to get what I want. I always want something in my life, and that's what I'm doing. I'm just bouncing back and forth between these things because of this childish ego. And then the second characteristic of that is this idea of defiance. You know, I am childishly defiant in my life. When they put rules up in my life, I don't want to follow them. I can't even deal with reality at all. You know, when I was a kid, my dad would say, you know, hey, don't go crawling up that tree, you know. Those branches are weak up there. You go up in that tree, those branches are going to break and you're going to fall on your head. And, you know, defiant as I am, I just would be right up in that tree and the branch would break and I'd fall down on the ground. And then I'd be looking for pity, you know, oh, geez, take care of me. How come you're not taking care of me? And what that defiance brings about this childish grandiosity. I have a 8-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter, and I'll tell you what, if they do something well, they want all the attention in the world, you know. And that's the way I am. I get on a crew of people, and it could be a one-day call, and there's 17 other painters there, and I'm telling myself how great I am, and I'm thinking that if I can perform for the boss, you know, that he'll know how great I am, and someday I'll probably get his job, because that's the way I think, you know. Pretty soon they're gonna be looking at me as the most important person on the crew. So whenever I do anything right, I have to explain it and show people how right I am and how great I am in what I do. And then of course if you tell a fish story, I'm telling a shark story. You know, you tell a shark story, I'm telling a killer whale story. And that's how my life goes, you know. You tell me, you know, oh, well, I got a drunk driving. Well, hey, I got 3 of them. I should have had a 4th one. You know, you tell me that you've been into a mental health hospital on the 5150. I've been there 3 times, spent plenty of time in those mental health hospitals, you know. You've been arrested. You've abandoned your children. You've done this. I've done it all better than you. And that's how that grandiosity works in my life. It's not just saying how much better I am, but also I'm telling you how much less. So we're never equal. I'm always above you or below you, and I'm looking for sympathy or I'm looking for praise in my life. And that's the way I operate in that grandiosity. So this is the power that's controlling my life, this impatience, this defiance, grandiosity, and this omnipotence kicks in to where, like, you know, hey, I've done this for you, you know, so you should be doing things for me. You know, I've taken care of I mowed your lawn, so, you know, why don't you wash my car, or, you know. All this stuff is going on in my life where I'm trying as hard as I can to get you to pay attention to me and take care of me, or to respect me and follow my orders. That's what I'm doing in my life, and that's how this omnipotence works in my life. Forever, that's the power that has been controlling my life. So I get a desire of self, and I take the ego as the power. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I look around, and I see people having some kind of experience in here. And I think their experience you know, is defined by the amount of money they're making, the girlfriend they have, the things that are going on. And that's what I start to think that I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. And fortunately for me, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1984, again, for a return visit by the court's order. And the consequences of my drinking had gotten pretty severe. And I think about that time I acted like a normal drinker. And I sobered up. And I started to attend a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I thought I was working the steps. And I thought I had a power in my life. But things were just going well enough in my life that I wasn't restless, irritable, and discontent all the time. And I didn't want to have a drink. I wanted to have a lot of things in my life. And I went after those with a gusto. But I was still restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't understand what these steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous were about. I didn't believe that I was powerless, although I said it. I didn't even understand what the word powerless meant, you know, and today I know that powerless is the complete inability to affect change. And that's what I found in my life today. I can't even change my mind. I'm on that crew of people and my mind is telling me how great I am and I want to quiet my mind. But of my own power, I can't even quiet my mind. I can't even sit there and be comfortable in my skin and be a member on that crew. I can't even live right size in the day that I'm in. And so again, you know, I'm telling those big fish stories over and over again and my life just becomes unmanageable, becomes completely unmanageable because I'm not working to any good effect. I'm not finding any comfort in what I'm doing. I'm always searching for something else that I want, that I think I need from that authority itself. And I'm in trouble. I'm quitting jobs. I'm quitting good jobs that are perfectly reasonable jobs. I'm finding my way into things that are going to make me, that I think are going to make me happy, that eventually end up causing me more pain in my life. I'm discarding people like they're just objects in my life, as if I'm changing my shoes. And I can't have any relationships with any other people in my life. And I'm trying to manage this stuff through my ego, and I come into Alcoholics Anonymous here, and I start to come to these meetings here, and I learn that, you know, this powerlessness, I can't affect any change. I lack the power to affect any change in my life. And I use that powerlessness word interchangeable with the unmanageable part of my life. My life is unmanageable. I am powerless to change my life, to have any effect of change in my life. Every time I try to affect any change in my life, it of my own power, I fail utterly again and again. And then I come in and I start to hear this thing that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And when I see that we came to believe, I relate with the chapter We Agnostics. And yeah, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous thinking I believed in a power. I thought I knew of a power for many years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous until I relapsed. And then I realized that my ideas about this power were about me living up to some kind of standards and things like that in my life. I needed to be moral, and I needed to do all these things that I thought that coincided with the religion that I was brought up in. And when I look at what came to believe, I believe that what they're trying to tell me is that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that I really didn't believe. So when I see we agnostics, looking at the word agnostics is two parts to the agnostics, the ag part meaning without, and gnostics meaning knowledge. So basically in my life, is I had no knowledge of a power. That's the absolute truth in my life. So these preconceived ideas that I thought I had knowledge of a power. I thought I could connect with a power through the way I was praying. I thought I could live to good purpose in my life, although I kept failing over and over again. So when I see that I had no knowledge of a power, I started to have to learn how to get a knowledge of that power. When I came into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to see people share on how their mind works in the day that they're in, and how this power of the ego was driving their lives with the authority of self. And I started to see that possibly I was praying in the wrong way, and I was meditating in the wrong way. And I started to get an idea of that, because I'd pray, I'd sit down, and I'd say, look at prayer, and I'd say, oh, prayer is asking God, and meditation is listening. And basically what I would do is I'd pray to God to help me in a situation, and then I'd tell him how to perform for me. And it would happen over and over again, and you know, sometimes by coincidence or whatever, the kind of direction I gave God would pan out, you know. But more times than not, I was still struggling in the world that I was in the day that I'm in. So I started to just try to quiet my mind and ask God to be with me. And when I found that I had a little bit of discipline to do that in my life, wonderful events started to happen. My mind started to quiet down little by little. It started to quiet down. I started to be able to talk with people that used to disturb me greatly, and be able to listen to them. Not just hear them and judge what they're saying. I started to be able to listen to them. Just listen to them talk and not give them any response on how they should solve what they have going on in their life or what they should do in their life, you know? And then I started to be able to listen to a little bit of a power in my life. A little bit of power and direction in my life that gave me the courage to move forward into step three. So I started to get this belief that this power could work in my life. And in step three, I started to learn a little bit about what those words mean. You know, when I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. So I had to think about what that meant. And in many Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I heard people talking about step three, and they were trying to define what God's will is. And that isn't really the thing that I found that I needed to do in step three. What I needed to do in step three is ask God to take a look at my thinking. Give me the ability to take a look at my thinking so that I could see what was going on in my head in the day that I'm in. And I could ask God to control my thinking. I could ask God to control my thinking in the day that I'm in, on that crew of people where I'm trying to get ahead of everybody else, or I'm looking for sympathy because, boy, I'm hurting today. Can you help me out? I got a headache, you know, because I never fit in. So I started to ask God to be able to control my thinking. And again, an amazing thing started to happen when I started to do that. When I started to ask God to control my thinking, my actions started to change. Now, I tell you, I had my sponsor, when I went into treatment this last time, my sponsor told me to just write some letters to my ex-wife to thank her for how she's raising our kids, and don't give her any big apologies or anything like that. And just thank her for raising your kids for you and all the things she does, managing the bills and taking care of all the stuff that's going on in our community property. Again, he didn't tell me to give her any amends, and I didn't do that. I didn't tell her, you know, how I'm going to get sober this time. I didn't tell her any of that stuff. I told her in those letters how much I appreciated what she was doing. And being new at prayer and meditation and having this contact with a power, I called her up one day, and we're just talking on the phone, and this is about the time that I had written her the third letter. And she says, wow, hey, thanks for sending me that letter. And the next words out of my mouth were, well, why didn't you thank me for the other two that I sent you? You know, can't you just thank me for the other two? That's the way I act. I mean, I don't know about you, but that's the way I act. And I can't change that. I could be in treatment for 52 weeks like Roland was. I could be in a mental health hospital, and they can give me the best drugs in the world. And as soon as they let me out of the mental health hospital or out of treatment, I'm down at the liquor store and I'm drinking, you know. Or I'm causing problems with people that I care about, people that I love. And that's what I said to her at that time. And I was able to see my mind working in a subconscious level that I needed that affirmation from her. And I was able to go to God in prayer and meditation, whereas in future events since then, God has been able to prevent those words from coming out of my mouth. And I'll tell you, sometimes I'm biting on my tongue. But sometimes the thoughts aren't even there to look for that response from her. It's amazing to me how well this idea of prayer and meditation works, and how when I can ask God to take my thoughts and my will being my actions, it's a measure beyond belief. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was totally broken. I was morally, spiritually, financially bankrupt. I've had this great ability to recover and go out and give it another shot. And I've had these ideas of surrender where I've gone into treatment and I haven't been able to follow through with it at all. I had to learn something about the difference between compliance and surrender. And what I found in my life is that surrender for me is when my desire to be with the power is greater than my desire to fulfill my basic instincts of life. Thank you. So on a daily basis, you know, the communication I have with the power carries me through the day that I'm in. I have to always, you know, look to the power in everything that I do. I consistently ask God to be with me. Just a curious thing of how quickly I can come, you know, back into self, the authorization of self, and using my ego as the power. I get my car back, and when I was taking my car over to my sponsor was driving me over to get the body work done, I looked at my car and I thought, wow, that's a really cool car. And I thought, you know, wow, I pictured myself and three other guys going to a meeting. It's like weird. And then things turn, you know. And then I look at my car and I picture me and a gal driving in it, you know. And that's the way it goes. But I heard this guy talk about asking God to be with him when he goes driving. So he'd open up the passenger door and ask God to come with him. And I started to do that in the mornings, and I did that for a while, and it was working great. It was amazing how I wasn't judging the people in front of me, and I wasn't afraid of how the people behind me were thinking about me as I'm driving down the roads. And then I noticed one morning I get up, I'm getting ready to go to work, and I open the passenger door, and I go, get in, God. Instead of asking him to come with me, it's like, get in. Because I'm in a hurry, man. Shut the door. And there we go, you know. That's what happens to me. So by saying that, what I'm saying is that it's a constant effort for me to stay in a conscious contact with the power. When I know I'm with the power, I know I'm there. When I'm not with the power, I know I'm there. And when I obstinately at times say, I don't want a power with me, then I'm really in trouble. And the only thing I can do at that time is come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where I can hear other people share what's going on in their life, how they're thinking, and how they apply these principles to their lives. Thank you. All right, now we have, it's time for participation. Sharing or questions.
George, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. I apologize for coming in late. For some reason, I thought the meeting started at 8 tonight. Let's show you my alcoholism. But I pretty much got a question for you. Everything you said just, like, hit home, you know, and I'm 6.5 years sober, and I can ask a question, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I got a mother that's a real controlling woman, you know. When I was using, she always controlled my life, and my dad's not doing well, and she doesn't leave the side, and so whenever I want to be with my father, my mother's got to come, no matter what, you know, and I'm ready to yoke this woman, you know. She drives me absolutely bonkers, who I should be with, what I should do, this, and that, and I've been telling her since I've been sober, Ma, I appreciate your advice, but I'm sober now, and I think that I, you know, I pretty much can handle, you know, what I need to do in my life, and like yesterday, my dad's like dying, you know, and it's like, the whole time she wouldn't shut up for 4.5 hours that I was in the call. I just don't know how, like, to pray for her anymore. I've been praying for years, you know. I've been praying for this woman for years, and yesterday I just looked over at my father and he went, and I said, you know, I'm ready to strangle this woman. I can't deal with her. How would you deal with an issue like that? I mean, I've asked other alcoholics and, you know, it was basically like, don't even go near her. Well, I want to be near my father in his dying days and I have to accept her because it's the only way I can be around her. And I've just had it. I'm just ready to strangle her. I'm just wondering how you would deal with an issue like this. Thank you.
The greatest thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, starts with reliance on a power, and I have to. The only thing that changes my attitude, Dr. Jung talked about ideas, emotions, and attitudes. And the only thing that changes my attitude is prayer. And it's not how many times I pray. It's not where I pray. It's not what I say. The whole time for me is the sincerity of my petition. If I can't multitask when I'm praying. If I'm saying, you know, God, can you give my ex-wife everything she wants in her life? And then, you know, and change her attitude towards me and have her clean the pool and why did she grass when we're in a drought, you know? If my mind is there when I'm asking God to change my attitude, then my petition is quite weak. If my mind is truly on forgiveness and asking God to change me and my attitude, that's the sincerest prayer that I can make.
George, alcoholic. And thank you for that. One thing you really jumped out at me that you said, I really like that you talked about that, was in step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And you made the really important distinction that it came to believe there, not that came to believe in a power greater than myself. Because I came here with that, and I've had that all along. It's coming to believe that power would actually restore me to sanity. And it kind of, that concept kind of involves what I think is really the essence of the primetime message. I mean, there's a lot of buzzwords it takes a little while to explain, like the ABCs, alcoholism, ego and self. But really, I have been listening a lot about Anderson, and I've been coming here since April, and I believe the essence of that message is the bifurcated nature of the first step, that there are two very different things being talked about there. The easy part, which is the powerlessness over alcohol. We all get that. And I remember hearing the old-timers always would say, it's the only part of the program you can work 100% in terms of the steps, is powerlessness over the alcohol, accepting the fact I got to put the plug in the jug and I can never drink again. But that second half of the first step, I think that's the real key, that it isn't necessarily talking about the same thing. It is not, oh, well, that insanity was while I was drinking and I put the plug in the jug and the insanity is gone. The unmanageability, whatever you want to call it. And that's the key, is we're talking about the thought life here. The thought life that continues to kill me in sobriety. I've been sober 22 and a half years, and it still continues to kill me when I let it. And that was an important thing here. I mean, and I had heard bits of this through the years. I've talked about this before. I had a sponsor tell me 10 years ago. He said, that brain is really good for things like cooking an egg, but it will kill you. And he also told me, you cannot trust anything that head tells you. Your head will always go to the worst possible interpretation of events. You know, I remember human resources wanted to talk to me once. I was convinced I was going to be fired because I bought something on eBay during lunch. Turned out they wanted me to help them with something because they heard I was a stand-up guy. I don't know where they could have heard that, but I mean, I always go to the worst possible interpretation of events. And if a lot of us have this story here, someone said it on that stage at the Friday night meeting a good while back at the Friday night speaker meeting, which is not a primetime meeting. They said, time will not heal all wounds, not in this room. And that's absolutely right, that this mistaken notion that just because I've been sober a long time, everything is fine. It is not. This thought life keeps it from being that way. And I think I've had an issue over the years as time's gone on. I think I've said it to my sponsor, too. I may believe that God restored me to sanity in terms of drinking. I mean, 22 years. I don't think I'm going to drink again. I really don't. I had the last time I had a serious thought of drinking was Christmas of 89. It was 20 years ago. I'm not that worried about that. I also don't think I'm going to put a gun to my head. But, you know, I'm settling for second best. You know, it's kind of like I have a guy I talk to a lot right now because I really like his program. In addition to my sponsor, I talked to this guy, and he's like, it's kind of like going all the way to the base of the mountain on this really grueling journey. Then it's like 1 mile up to the top of the mountain. I'm just going to camp down at the bottom of the mountain. That's good enough, you know? And I don't really want that. You know, but it's this kind of came to believe that power could restore me to sanity. Yeah, that's the part. I don't necessarily believe it will restore me to the thought sanity. I do believe it will restore me to drinking sanity, and I have confidence it will continue to as long as I do a few simple things like keep showing up here and taking actions. But I would like thought sanity, too. And I'll finish with this. I was just reading again in Sermon on the Mount. Because I have been told that that is the main piece of literature that's going to have the most value for me in terms of the primetime message. And he talks about there, I don't know, around 12, 13, 14, those pages. That is what Jesus talked about when he meant damnation and hell and all that. It's the hell of my thought life here on earth, the hell that I make, a hell of my own making. We're not talking about after death and afterlife. And that is all controlled by my thoughts, that whatever I think, that's what's going to be happening around me. I can have a good life if I'm thinking good thoughts. I bring good things into my life. I think the crap I think, I'm going to get that in my life. So, interesting. Thanks.
Actually, I took my 6-month chip on Friday the 13th. Yeah, I just want to sort of like piggyback on what the guy just said just now. You know, what always happens to me is there's a thought in my mind that says I'm going to die over something. It inevitably
goes there. I got something going on right now I won't even talk about. There's just so much bullshit. Oh, excuse me. It's a lie. And yet, and if I don't have a thought like that and everything seems to be nice, like it's a beautiful spring day in Washington, D.C., as the More About Alcoholism talks about, I'll invent something. What's going on? What's going on there? And how do you stop that? How do you stop this thing in here that keeps telling you you're going to die? You know, what is that? And how do you stop it from happening? How does, the other thing is that, just a candid thing about God with me. I thought I had all the answers when I came into prime time about 3 months ago or 4 months ago, because I'm a Messianic Jew, and I thought I really, now I had it really made Hanukkah and Christmas all rolled into one. And I broadcasted it over the mic, now I just realize that I don't have anything in my, I don't think I have a God, because judging from the way I think, and what's going on with me, and the nervous wreck that I am, I'm sleeping all the time. I think and I'm not drinking, but I'm sleeping a lot. I mean, I sleep just too many hours a day. So I don't have a God in my life as working, and I went through the 12 steps, which is really, I'm just being very candid. How do you, I guess I'm saying that, and I'm also asking the question, how do you stop that thing from telling you you're going to die? I mean, it's going on with me right now as I speak, so.
Paul, I'm actually diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. Now, it's kind of funny right now. but when you're me and you're, when I'm at my house or wherever I'm at, I was in treatment in Pasadena and I'd ride the bus to Mar Vista, south by Santa Monica, and I'd be waiting for the bus and paranoid schizophrenic at 5 o'clock in the morning waiting for a bus is not a good place to be. Really, it's scary. And because there's lights that twinkle at night in the dark. And there's people that drive cars even at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And there's people that go places and there's cops that drive by. And there's things that go bump in the night. And my sponsor and my counselor both told me that I can, my sponsor didn't know, wasn't talking about the paranoid schizophrenic, my counselor was, but I can get a thought in my head and I can just start to energize it. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, somebody looks at me, and just looks at me, we sit down and they're part of a conspiracy and I can start looking for evidence to support that. You talk about, you know, possibly dying, you know, whatever. I could start to look for that in my life. I could start to look for people that have been part of some kind of covert intervention thing that was going on in my life or whatever. And I could start to energize that, you know, even at, 15 months abstinent right now, 15 months in sobriety, and 15 months developing a relationship with a power. So when that thought enters my head, I have a choice to either continue to energize that thought, or I can ask a power to take that thought from me. I can't wish that thought away. No matter how hard I try, I could say, oh, I'm not going to think about that. I'm going to think about something else. And I just keep thinking about that. I keep thinking about that. I keep thinking about that. And Emmett Fox was mentioned in here, and he talks about the golden key. And the golden key is just ask God to take that thought and don't tell him what to do with it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Elaine. I'm an alcoholic. And Swiss Frank, I think, said at the last meeting about when the ego starts, and I've really been trying to, it's really helped me all week, when the ego starts futuring and saying, anything negative, you know, anything bad, anything negative, anything scary, even things like, you know, I'm too tired, or I can't do that, or, you know, whatever it is, I just go, ah, that's not God. That thought, I see that thought. And when I do my meditation now in the morning, I say, I'm the observer, and the thoughts flow through like the waves on the ocean. But I don't have to surf them. You know, I could just watch it go by. And now I could go, oh, that thought, not from God. So I don't have to energize it. Doesn't mean I'm going to not have them. I still have them. But I go, now I can go, oh, no, that's the ego. I don't have to go there. I just have to turn my will and everything I've got and my future and everything else over to God. I have to really pray for the willingness to align my will with God's will. And that's all that I could do. And look around and see how beautiful everything is and be grateful for what's there. And just know that the pain will pass. And if I just keep praying and just keep watching the thoughts and go, not energizing it, then little by little, they don't bother me quite as much. And I'm able to go, well, you know, even if for a minute I start to entertain it, I go, well, if that's it, that's it. And then I go, wait, no, that's not it. That's that future circling thing that starts going, well, then this, and then I do that, and then if I do this, and then that, and then I go, then I'm lost, you know. So I try not to even get on the track. I try to just like see, no, whatever, God's will. Take it, God's will. And it really, it's kind of hard to do at first, because then you start going, well, what am I going to think about then? You know, it's like, that took up all my, I spent a lot of time doing those circles, you know, planning all these things. And it's just like, now I listen for the silence. The silence is good. So not so bad. You know, it's unfamiliar, but it's not so bad. However, I do find that the television set, I listen to the radio, but the TV set for some reason really relieves a lot of it, you know, because I could just like go somewhere else for a while, and that's a big help. I know I don't want to get addicted to anything else, certainly not that, but music sometimes can do it, you know, although that sometimes gets a little emotional, but just something to direct my mind, and reading is good too. Anything that's going to take your mind is good. So thanks for letting me share.
My name is Rick. I'm in Alcoa.
Hi, Rick.
Thank you very much, Guy. I'm glad that you mentioned the definition of powerlessness, the inability to affect any change. You know, it's been kind of a common thread about thought tonight. And, you know, for me, the way I interpret my responsibility in being a good human is, and it says it in the foreword, it says that, that so the disease is there to see and recognize. I'm always going to have thoughts. A wise man who once said, if you're not thinking, if you're not having any thoughts, you're probably dead, because we're thinking even when we're asleep, and those, you know, obviously. So I can't stop this from going. But what I can do is watch the good thoughts come and watch the bad thoughts come, and then it's my job to decipher that's alcoholism. Then I go ask God, please don't let me think that. But I have a responsibility here, because if I know what is, obviously I know the difference between right and wrong, and I did wrong for many, many years. But I can still suffer from, you know, from alcoholism sober. It doesn't matter how long. I mean, time away from the bottle is just that for me. I mean, it's just time away from the bottle. I can still have the thoughts of, you know, I can still be very infantile. I can still be restless, irritable, and discontent. and be judgmental and be critical and be bitter, and then I'm throwing my life away. I did it the other day on the freeway. I was running a little late, and I just threw a half hour away, you know, out of a 45-minute drive. I was like, you know. But I recognized it, and I said, God, please help me accept this situation. Another just brief example, I was at a meeting where there was just insane, just foul profanity. I mean, it was just vile coming out of this person, and I just thought, and I asked God, that's God's will. No fight. You know, there's no fight there. And then I have peace. I mean, that's what I drank for. I drank for peace of mind. And, you know, that's one of the things. See, because Ted used to say that he was a bankrupt perfectionist. I just love that expression because I really, you know, that describes me, a bankrupt perfectionist. And I can't have any peace unless the world is perfect, which it will never be. So I have to find a way to reduce, well, as the book would say, reduce the demands. Or like in step 7, it says living on a basis of unsatisfied demands. See, because I'm always thinking this should be a certain way. And so when I am able to identify that thought of, oh, this is right or this is wrong, and identify that, oh, I'm being judgmental and I'm probably playing God and telling God that he's wrong, or I'm complaining about one of God's children and what they are doing, I can identify that as alcoholism and then ask for help. Because I'm certainly going to have a lot of thoughts. And you know what? The more I do that, the more they get quieter. Those bad thoughts just get quieter. They're like, oh, you should tell that person to go. You know, it's like, no, I should be. And the more I get into the literature, too, I mean, I stop fighting anyone, anything. Love and tolerance is our code. That is a huge statement. Love and tolerance is our code. I mean, a code. I mean, that's like everywhere in our lives. I mean, love and tolerance. I'm supposed to be loving and tolerant. You know, I'm supposed to be meditating every morning asking God what I can do each day for the man who's still sick. I'm supposed to be asking God every morning how to get out of myself and be of service, to be a giver instead of a taker. And for me, that's really clear, you know. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. Anyway, I need help. I'm always going to need help. And that's probably one of the greatest gifts that I've ever been given, is that I know I can't do this alone. And I also know that I will never be alone as long as I stay in the program. So, thanks.
My name's Cliff. I'm an alcoholic. I got a mental illness. And when I go to my mind, I go to my problem. And, you know, that's all I knew at one time, was to go to my mind. I before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, where else are you going to go? You know? And I was constantly into trouble. And, you know, way back when I found alcohol, and it took all that insanity out. You know, I felt okay. You know, like they say, you take that drink and it's just, everything's cool. And, so it was, I thought, you know, it was like it was treating my mind, alcohol. You know, I wasn't so bad off now. My anger wasn't so bad. My fear wasn't so bad. But of course, I'm an alcoholic, so it got a hold of me and the alcohol took me down. So when I came in here, you know, I can't drink anymore. But I came in here, and I found out I'm supposed to do certain things here to stay sober and clean. But when I came in here with everything I was about up to then, which was insanity, you know, alcoholism. That's all I had when I came in here. I had no program except my own. And so I started doing this stuff. And I remember my first year like it was yesterday. You know, it was just one insanity after another. You know, it was either a whole lot of fear or it was a whole lot of anger. I got into physical confrontations a few times because I didn't know how to handle them. I just handled them the way I used to. But in the program, you started to, I said, give me the program. And what do? And they gave me a program. These guys gave you a program. I started doing that on a daily basis. So it kept me sober, But I was still crazy, because I have to learn how to do this stuff to really apply it in my life. And I did, you know, and I got there to the point where my life was changing. And I got sober in 81 of November, 29th. And I've been working for this company for 12 years now. And I did real good at it in the beginning. And in fact, when I was there 3 years, they wanted me to represent them back east in the big meeting that they have back east for all of my marketing centers. So, you know, I got this big ego. You talk about low self-worth all mixed up in there. So I went back there and I represented this marketing center. Man, that's pretty good, man. You know, I'm moving right along here. And, but I still got the same mind. It's warped. Somehow I warped my mind. You know, and I said it in stone with alcohol. And when my ego gets in there, I go to my mind and, you know, different things happen. So, but I'm going well there, and my life is changing, and most of the time I'm aware of my disease, but not always. And lately, I've been at war with my company because they've got new policies. They can care less about the customers, and they're going in a different direction, and it's bothering me. And what it is I haven't surrendered, that I'm not the company. I work for them, and I'm fighting them now, you know. And all of a sudden, I sell maintenance agreements for this company and talk to customers all over the country about service and all that. All of a sudden, I can't sell maintenance agreements anymore. And the other day, I was looking in my drawer, and I had all these things that said, gave me awards constantly, a bunch of them, the way I sold and the way I treated customers. And I can't do that anymore. I mean, what the hell is going on here, man? You know. And I'm talking to my higher power about this. Show me the way. And I'm reading the 12 and 12, and I got into 6 and 7. I'm looking at 7, humility, you know. And I'm talking to my sponsor. You know, I've come to understand, I don't have a hell whole lot of humility. You know? And that's the truth, you know, and I started looking at that. And I need help at work. I'm the big man over there, but now I need help. I ain't the big man. I never was the big man, but my mind tends to go different directions when I do well, you know, at something, you know, all that shit, you know, unless I understand it and I back away from it. And so I started talking to my manager, and she said, "What is happening with you?" I said, I don't know how to sell these anymore. You know, I got to get my humility going here. I got to quit being a big man. She said, "Well, maybe you need, I'm talking about it. Well, what do you mean you don't know?" And I talked to her about it. I said, "I don't know. I just can't do it." But what happened was, I asked her to there's some people that do well there that haven't been there nearly as long as me. So I asked them to help me with that. I gave in. I let go, and I went to somebody. I needed help, because I didn't look at it that I needed help at that place. Every place else I needed help, but now I realized I needed help there, and one more time I had to use the program. And I kicked in where some people helped me and gave me some ideas, and it was just the idea that I did that. It wasn't so much the actual help they gave me. Everything has turned around in the last week and a half. I like it again, you know, and things are going well again. Because I surrendered one more time to another thing that was giving me problems. And that's what the program is about, is, you know, it's about surrendering to things I can't control, people I can't control, you know, surrendering, and get help from other people, get some ideas from other people, and because I can't run the show. And I know.
My name's Adam. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, guy. I definitely relate to some of the things that I'd heard said from George and Paul and so forth. And like the thought has occurred to me recently, it's just how terrible I am at returning phone calls or even answering the phone or responding to emails, texts, and like the fact now that there's all these new devices, people have new ways of getting in touch with me. It just seems to compound the issue. I just want to unplug myself from everything. And I think a lot of this stems from I have this relentless pursuit and idea, this it's kind of entrenched in me that, you know, things should be better, that my life should be better, and that I'm running out of time. You know, the idea that I'm going to die, not in any immediate sense, but, you know, that it's not the way it should be, and that I need to act to improve my conditions, you know, kind of leads me to neglecting, you know, opportunities when they present themselves, such as, you know, interacting and having these relationships with other people, because I just kind of push everything aside. And kind of implicit in this is the idea, obviously, that things aren't right. They're good enough as they are. This is where I kind of get the question I had is, you know, when I kind of get along this train of thought and go down this road, and I start thinking in a more cosmic sense, you know, I think that the Earth is 13.7 billion years old, and like that I'm on a very, very minor planet and around a minor star, of which there's billions, and, you know, and I think I really am very inconsequential. Yet, you know, I have this overwhelming sense of importance and urgency, you know, of like all these things I've got to get done. And it's just like, it's a blip. It's a total blip. And it's good. And that's kind of an aspect of, I think, my spirituality. But in that, that sense of feeling inconsequential, can lead me to feeling just that, inconsequential. You know, well, what does it matter? This is not, you know, this is very temporal. What difference does it make? So how do you reconcile that idea of ego deflation, of kind of right-sizing oneself and prioritizing and relating to other people with, you know, the idea that it is somewhat insignificant? I mean, whatever it is that I am to do, that idea of powerlessness, and yet still going out, I guess, in the community and being a good person and having positive relationships, if that makes sense.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm sitting over there praying, and Adam's talking. We will comprehend the word serenity. You know, it's one of the promises that come, you know, in the ninth step promises. We'll comprehend the word serenity. And serenity is the knowledge of God, the knowing of the presence of a power. And when one of the things, the tools that I learned in meditation is that I do a lot of different types of meditation. And one, I breathe in. God is everything, and everything is God. And I started to do that one day, and it was the weirdest thing that happened to me. It was, you know, it was faces and trees and just different things of the universe just started popping into my head. And each one of those things, individually and collectively, were God. The book Alcoholics Anonymous says that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental conception of God. I believe that God is inside of me and inside of everybody. And when I have that serenity, the knowing of the presence of a power, that's when I'm connected with everything in the universe, and everything's connected with me. Nancy?
I'm Nancy, an alcoholic. And I loved your question because I totally suffer from that existential angst of like, what is the point of this? I mean, every day I'm like, what is the point of this? But when I go into my shop and I open the doors and somebody comes in and maybe they're going to buy something and maybe they're not, and I have an opportunity to listen to another human being, it makes life purposeful. It completes me. It's not how much money I'm shoving in my pocket. You know, it's not about that. It's about, am I being of service today? Can I listen to another human being? I get a lot of, like, because I have a thrift shop, you know. I get people who are a little bit, you know, I'm a little too. You know, I'm right there with them. But they're a little bit more than me sometimes. And guess what? I'm of service. I'm listening. And I get to know their names. You know, if I'm returning somebody's call, I have a purpose. You know, if I'm avoiding people, because I like to avoid people, I would rather not talk to anyone, really, most of the time. I would just be perfectly fine to sit behind the desk and not see anybody and just take the money and not have to deal with it. But you know what? When I look up and I look at somebody in the eyes and I say, how are you today? And I'm there and I'm of service in any small way. That gives my life purpose. The futility of life to me is the worst thing in the world. I want to die if I don't have a purpose. There's no reason. I mean, I don't get it. The whole rat race about having, 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 and then this and that, and for what? Because it's still going to be hard. But if I can just help make one person's life a little bit better each day, or do something that I know I should, returning that phone call, it's better.
Peter. Oh, thanks for raising your hand.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's true. I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic. I stopped drinking when I got sober too, and I'm a creature of habit, so my thoughts keep coming into my head. And that was my dilemma of finding out what was wrong with me. And you talk about slipping. I came to Alcoholics 13 years before I had my last drink, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And so I continued to treat myself with the alcohol so everything would be okay. And, you know, it's fascinating listening to the shares tonight and talking about relationships with other people, you know, for a gentleman talking about, you know, his mom and his dad, and most of us have moms and dads, and my dilemma when I got sober was I love my mother and I hate my father, and how I go and visit them and have a Sunday dinner and sit at the same table with loving one person and hating another, it doesn't work out very well. And so I got some direction from the guy who was my sponsor, and it was, you know, the idea of getting intellectual, of knowing God and all this. I mean, I can do that in spades, you know, but I just can't figure out how to do it in my life. And he says, well, allow that person that you're having problems with, allow them to be right, even when they're wrong, as long as they're not injuring you. So that was something I started to do with my dad. And, you know, he's 100 years old now. And, you know, my mom died 3 years ago. She was 97. So the whole story is, and I've been sober for 16 years. So in that time span, I was able to build a good relationship with both these people. I mean, amongst others, but, you know, the closest ones to me. And so it was terrific that I was able to go there on Sundays, you know, help take care of my mom, and now I help take care of my dad. But I talk to him twice a day. I put it into practice. I have to put effort into all these actions of getting along with somebody else. I can't just sit there and think nice thoughts and everything's okay, but I have to get out there and commit myself and give a call. And a lot of times, you know, for me, I'm an alcoholic. I mean, my thinking goes from one side of the universe to the other. And he's like talking about, well, how's the weather? How's the stock market? How's your job? How's, you know, it's a very formatted conversation, but I go with it now. And it's all okay. I don't expect to get something out of it that, you know, that I need or desire, you know, what's in it for me.
And so it's a wonderful relationship. And always at the end of the conversation I have with him and my brother, it's a speakerphone thing, which is always a lot of fun. I'm on one end, and these two people are on the other end, and I'm trying to be able to respect their space and all at the same time. But it always ends up with, I love you. And, you know, for me to be able to say that to this guy that 16 years ago I really wished him great ill and wished that he would die. And so now I have a new respect for him, to accept him as he is, and not to insist that he becomes somebody other than, you know, who he is. And I've come to appreciate him much more now than I did back then. So he's become a very valued part of my life. And, you know, it's amazing what happens when we're able to have some peace of mind in this program, just, you know, past the point of not drinking, of who do I become. And things fall apart every day in my life. And, you know, it's when I'm at work, so I try to take care of myself and connect with that power, but I have to do it every day. And, you know, that's the key for me. And just like a guy talking about, you know, writing letters to his wife, and telling her how much he appreciated what it is that she does. And that's what I try to do with the people that are around me. There's always something that they're doing, which is a benefit for me, that I can find a bright spot. And that's the thing that helps me get together, even like, you know, having a divorce. You get divorced, but you still got a partnership. You still got two young kids. So the relationship continues despite the divorce. So that's what it's about. Thank you.
Okay, we still have time.
Oh. Okay.
Hi, my name's Erica. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here and for speaking with us, and I appreciate it a lot. I just wanted to get up and say that I'm grateful that I was at this meeting tonight. You know, for me, my recovery is completely based upon building a new character, because the one that I've developed I've just completely warped my character. I mean, I came in here just so diseased and so broken, and, you know, most of us come in with a character based on, you know, what we experienced in childhood or in society growing up, and then I, at least, had experiences that led me to abusing drugs and alcohol and a way of seeing the world that was just so horrible and negative that I just started to self-destruct. And then, after a certain amount of time, warped my mind, and, you know, I suffer from a spiritual malady. So I, you know, I'm sick mentally, and I also suffer from a spiritual malady. Well, so what I'm trying to say is that, yeah, the theme tonight seems to be thoughts, and just the way that we think and the inner man. My goal is to have a change of character. My goal is to change the inner man, because, you know, I came in here so broken that I don't even want what I used to have anymore. And it is a daily thing for me. I practice it sincerely. I mean, I'm sicker than others. I have to work this thing really, really hard. I meditate every single day. I do have to watch my thoughts all the time. And I do have to invite God in all the time. I relate. Sometimes I'm around people that absolutely drive me nuts. And, you know, it doesn't matter what the circumstance is. It matters what's going on inside. It matters where I am spiritually inside. Doesn't matter what the circumstance is ever. And so, at least this is what I'm learning, and it works. So I can be around somebody that absolutely is driving me crazy, like I can't stand it. And so then I go to God, and I apply this thing. And I say, God, please show me how to see this person in a different light, or please show me how to respond in a way that would be helpful here. And it is the weirdest thing. It's like thoughts will come to me that are not, that I generally wouldn't think, and it works. I can either see this situation in a different way, or I can contribute something to the situation that I wouldn't have before. And so I am such a youngster in this whole thing. Like, I'm totally growing. But it works. And one more thing I want to say, and then I'll stop, is just that a tool that I've learned that really works, you know, when it comes to being kind of stuck in the past and worried about, like, I don't know, having regrets or guilt or future tripping, is like being in the here and now. And being in the here and now is where I access God. So if I stopped right now and just like listen for a second, and I'm in the here and now, everything's okay. And, you know, we're here, we're in this room listening to each other. There's always good energy in an AA meeting. And in the here and now is such a good tool for me to remember when I'm in fear or unhappy with my circumstances or thinking I'm going to die or whatever the case might be. If I'm just right here in the here and now, I'm okay. So I just wanted to share some of that.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.